1 Corinthians chapter 13 is a chapter of the Bible that has taken on a life of its own, and I don't say that as a criticism. Psalm 23, Romans 8, Luke 15, the story of the prodigal son, these are parts of the Bible that are so exquisitely crafted and so brilliantly communicated and so lofty in the ideas that they carry, that they do take on a life in our minds, in our consciousness, and to an extent in our culture. And they deserve to do so. 1 Corinthians 13, I think, is one of those passages. Justifiably soaring into our hearts and minds, so beautifully written and so powerfully communicated and so evocative. One of those passages that you can feed on again and again and discover new things each time you return to it. So I wanted to read it to you, and I wanted just to let you enjoy it and let it take you to wherever it takes you. 1 Corinthians 13. And yet I will show you the most excellent way. If I speak in the tongues of men or of angels, but have not love, I am only a resounding gong or a clanging cymbal. If I have the gift of prophecies and can fathom all mysteries and all knowledge, if I have a faith that can move mountains but do not have love, I am nothing. If I give all I possess to the poor and give my body over to hardship that I may boast, but do not have love, I gain nothing. Love is patient, love is kind. It does not envy, it does not boast, it is not proud. It does not dishonour others, it's not self-seeking, it's not easily angered, it keeps no record of wrongs. Love does not delight in evil, but rejoices with the truth. It always protects, always trusts, always hopes, always perseveres. Love never fails. Where there are prophecies, they will cease. Where there are tongues, they will be stilled. Where there's knowledge, it will pass away. For we know in part, and we prophesy in part. But when completeness comes, what is in part disappears. When I was a child, I talked like a child. I thought like a child. I reasoned like a child. When I became a man, I put the ways of childhood behind me. For now we see only a reflection as in a mirror. Then we shall see face to face. Now I know in part, then I shall know fully, even as I am fully known. And now these three remain, faith, hope, and love. But the greatest of these is love. I'd be interested to know in your mind where that took you, in your imagination, in your heart, in your mind. I guess, as Gavin said before, the paradigm situation of 1 Corinthians 13 is the wedding service. I think that's where it's most commonly encountered. And if you're a fan of 90s Richard Curtis romantic comedies, perhaps you heard the voice of the guy from Four Weddings and a Funeral as he read this at the funeral. Perhaps you remember it from Princess Diana's funeral or some other state occasion where this passage was read. And because it's found a home in those kinds of occasions, at the funeral of Princess Diana, at weddings and in popular culture, as you hear it, you can almost imagine, I think, I imagine kind of the wedding scene, you know, the couple in splendour, dressed, the crowd there, happy to be there on a Saturday, leaning forward as the passage is read. I can almost see this, and I think maybe I physically have seen this, that as 1 Corinthians is read in the wedding service, couples just kind of squeezing each other's hands and maybe looking at each other, love is patient, love is kind. And you can kind of imagine guys at the wedding reception afterwards just using kind of Christian pickup lines like, hey, baby, when they read that passage, I thought of you. The passage has taken on a kind of life of its own. And as I say, that is no criticism. It is for very good reasons. You would be a very cold heart if you thought this was anything other than a spectacular passage. But here's the thing. When it was first read out in Corinth, it is very unlikely that anybody's instinct was to squeeze someone else's hand. It is very unlikely that anyone thought there were some good pickup lines here after the service. In fact, when 1 Corinthians 13 was first read in Corinth, I think you'd be much more likely to have seen arms getting folded, to have seen people starting to lean back in their chairs. I think the looks that went across the room were not looks of love interest one to another, but looking across at factional leaders, looking across at rogue house churches and thinking, this is so, so awkward. Because, I mean, think about the context into which this beautiful passage was originally said. The problem is a church divided, specifically over the question of the gift of speaking in tongues and the gift of prophecy and the place of the charismatic gifts in the church. And into that context, Paul says, if I speak in angelic or human tongues but have no love, I am a resounding gong or clanging cymbal. He hasn't just picked that from nowhere as a random thing that might happen somewhere else. I think, in fact, Paul's only concession to good manners in this passage is the use of the personal pronoun I, by which, of course, he means you. He says, if I speak in angelic or human tongues but have not love, I'm a resounding gong or clanging cymbal, by which he means if you do that, you're a resounding gong or clanging cymbal. And his only concession to not getting, like, tarred and feathered and kicked out as the founding pastor of that church is this slight concession by the word I. And he goes on in verse 2, you know, he says, if I have the gift of prophecy and knowledge, which is the gift that he's going to favour in chapter 14, but have not love, then I am nothing, aka you are nothing. In verse 13, if I give all I have to the poor, but do not have love, I gain nothing. Even in there, the gift that he's going to go on and favour in chapter 14 is the gift of prophecy. He's about to say, do you know what? You guys should rate prophecy much higher than you do. And yet he reserves the most fierce criticism for prophecy minus love. So with the other two, he says, if I speak, then that's nothing. And if I give my body to be burnt, then I gain nothing. But if I prophesy without love, I am nothing. The chapter 1 Corinthians 13 goes across a divided church, a church that's imploding, and he says, without love, nothing. Without love, nothing. Without love, you are nothing. And that is the context for these hauntingly beautiful words. And as we've said, they are the grenade at the heart of the passages that we're looking at over this weekend, because it's as Paul pulls the pin and throws this into the Corinthian church that he expects a radical reevaluation of the gifts, of their attitude to each other, to discipleship, and to the very question of what makes for a life worth living. Of which life and of which church could you say that was not nothing? That was worth it. So that's the passage, 1 Corinthians 13. I just wanted you to notice as we start to get stuck into it, the way it sits in its passage. If you've got a Bible, actually, you can see this pattern elsewhere. Feel free to trust me if you want to just stay in there. But a thing that Paul does in 1 Corinthians is has this pattern of threes where he'll talk about an issue and then talk about something that seems to be something completely different, but then go back to the issue with a new understanding. So, for example, in chapter 7, he's talking about marriage and singleness and sexual relations. And then in the middle, verses 17 to 24, he starts talking about jobs and ethnicity and circumcision. And then he goes back to marriage. And what he's doing is saying, here's the hot situation that's going down. then here's the key to unlocking it, and then let's go back to the situation. Or if you go on again to chapter 8, is about food sacrifice to idols. Chapter 10 is about food sacrifice to idols. And chapter 9 is about paying your pastors. And what he's doing is talking about raising the issue, then he returns to the issue, and in the middle, he has the thing that seems to be off track, but is actually unlocking the thing for you. And that's exactly what's happening here in chapter 13 before he returns to the question of the gifts. Now, the passage itself, I think it's got three really obvious sections. Verses 1 to 3, where he says that love transcends. Verses 4 to 7, where he says that love acts. And verses 8 to 13, where he says that love endures. Love transcends, love acts, and finally, love endures. Firstly, love transcends. The context we've seen is this bun fight over which gift is the favoured and more prestigious gift and so on, and that everyone should be doing, that the church should make room for people to do what they want to do, or people should stand aside, or everyone should adopt the gift, or whatever it is, whichever way the church has been colonised by this gift. And Paul wants to say, first of all, that love isn't a gift or a thing that you should add to church life, but it transcends the gifts. It transcends the spiritual manifestations. And so in verse 1, as we saw, he says, if I speak in human or angelic tongues but have not love, I'm a resounding gong or clanging cymbal. The controversy is over tongues, and he says, tongues without love is worthless, even angelic tongues. Verse 2, if I have the gift of prophecy and can fathom all mysteries, and can move mountains with faith but do not have love, I am nothing. Not just I have nothing, but I am nothing. I don't know about you, I don't know if this is particularly like a self-revealing moment, or whether some of you, or maybe most of you, share this, but I think one of my biggest fears in life, I don't know if it's a male thing, a Rory thing, or whatever, is to kind of amount to being a person of no consequence. To be someone who, at the end of his life, they just said, you know, lightweight, or, you know, just didn't amount to anything. And I wonder how many books are written, how many degrees are taken, how many marriages are entered into, how many sporting achievements are accomplished, how many careers are forwarded on the fuel of the insecurity that you may amount to nothing, that you may be someone of no consequence. And Paul's haunting words here is that a life without love is inconsequential. That a life without love, despite the books that are written and the degrees that are taken and the achievements that are accomplished, a life without love is nothing. That all our achievements are nothing. That all our efforts to be the church, to evangelize this city, all that we do and all that we say is nothing without love. Now, Paul is using a particular kind of figure of speech here. He's using strong language. He's talking in exaggerated kind of terms about the importance of love and so on. And so it almost sounds like he's saying that nothing matters without love. It almost sounds like he's saying that, you know, if you get together as church, it's not worth it unless there's love. And it's almost like he's saying that you could do a whole degree in theology, and if there was no love, it wasn't kind of worth anything, or that you could run a conference, and if there was no love, it kind of wasn't worth anything. And just to clarify, that's exactly what he's saying. That is absolutely what he means. Every book, every conference, every church service, every song, every achievement is nothing without love. Which raises the question, what is love? If there is this thing in the world without which everything is worthless, what is this thing? And Paul, in verses 4 to 7 in the next section, attempts to answer not with a definition, but with a description. He gives, I think, not a definition of what love is, but a way of spotting it in the wild, a way that you could say things that exhibit these characteristics in the wild, they are love. And you see that in that section, verses 4 to 7. What is love? Well, you can spot it because it's patient and kind, and it doesn't envy, and it doesn't boast, and it's not proud, and it's not self-seeking, and it keeps no record of wrongs. One of the popular narratives of the new atheism of Dawkins and Hitchens and so on is the idea that we don't need religion, specifically we don't need Christianity, and more specifically we don't need God for morality, because morality is a self-evident thing that you can just derive from rational reflection on the world. And to be fair, the new atheism is partly true in that. So I think you can look at the world, can you not, and work out that in tribal societies and in village societies and in cities and so on, pretty much most people around the world have worked out that there ought to be some sort of moral prohibition on murder, and that you shouldn't sleep with people that you're closely related to, and stealing and so on. There's all sorts of things where, people under control experiments without any relationships to each other work out these things. And so that's a fair enough observation that there is kind of a baseline of shared morality that you kind of work out, because without which societies would collapse. But the new atheism, I think, often has a tin ear to history and to culture, and particularly to the way Christianity has shaped our moral imaginations. And these verses, verses 4 to 7, are a case in point. Because if they're obvious to you as examples of love, they are by no means obvious in the culture into which Paul spoke. For example, Paul says that love is kind. And kindness appears nowhere on Aristotle's list of virtues. Kindness in the Greco-Roman world was thought of as like a kind of effeminate family value that was shared between mothers and children, and not a noble aspiration to be shared in public. Kindness is seen as weak and effeminate. And conversely, he says in verse 4, he says somewhere that love does not boast. And boasting in the Greco-Roman world is an uncontroversial, I've got it there in verse 3, is an uncontroversial activity. Like the conventions in hip-hop or rap music, as you extol your virtues as you sing the songs. In the ancient world, it was like that boasting is what you did to get ahead. And Paul says specifically, love, as in what I mean by love, does not do that, does not boast. And more recently, the brilliant and non-tin-eared to history Christopher Hitchens singles this out, and particularly singles out forgiveness. Notice there he says, love keeps no record of wrongs. Christopher Hitchens said that is one of the worst ideas that Christianity ever bestowed on Western civilization. He said, and the delightfully and admirably late, consistent Christopher Hitchens says, it is an awful value to keep no record of wrongs. You need to remember who your enemies are. Specifically in Christopher Hitchens' case, he says that there's a thing called Islamic militantism, and there's a thing called the West, and this planet isn't big enough for the both of us, and we need to recognise that they are our enemy. But here, the love that Paul is talking about is the kind of love that keeps no record of wrong, that delights in forgiveness. Which is a long way of saying that this passage is not shaped by a generic vision of love, but by a specific experience of Jesus. It is in the wake of the way Jesus lived and the way that he died that these ideas of kindness, of keeping no record of wrong, come online as a definition, as a new definition of what love is. Verses 1 to 3, Paul extols love as transcendent. In 3 to 7, he describes love as patient and kind and non-boastful and not proud. And thirdly and finally, in the last section, he says that love is eternal. Love, as one of the commentators says, is like a river that flows into the new country, into the new creation, into eternity itself. That's why he can say there that love, verse 8, never fails. He means that love lasts forever, that love lasts into eternity. And that's not true of prophecy. And that's not true of tongues. And though it breaks my heart to say it, I don't think it's true of Bible teaching. I don't think I get to preach in the new creation. And made all this effort of trying to learn how to do this thing. And then in the new creation, I don't think that's really worth anything. Who would want to listen to a preacher if Jesus is among you? And, you know, all this effort we go to work on our gift of tongues or prophecy or being a Bible teacher or busting out the music or whatever. And Paul is saying, do you know what? The thing that carries to the new creation is love. All your hobby horses fall aside, all your contingencies, all your achievements fall aside, and love remains. And Paul gives these two pictures, images to get around your head this difference between our perspective from now and perspective in eternity. There's the picture of the child, firstly, in verse 11. He's trying to help you understand, to think about the present in light of the future. And he says, verse 11, when I was a child, I talked like a child, I thought like a child, I reasoned like a child. And that's not especially bad. Just like the exercise of gifts is not especially bad. He doesn't, it'd be a very short chapter if the Corinthians said, should we be doing tongues? And he said, no. Or should we be doing prophecy? No. But we've got these three chapters because they're not bad. But he says there's something about the way they think about the gifts that is childish. And that in the light of eternity, we are able to put childish ways behind us. It's a very gentle picture, as I say, because it's not a picture of right or wrong, that there's a tongues faction and a prophecy faction and the winner is tongues or the winner is prophecy. You know, he says, both of you, just, it's kind of childish. Not what you do, but the way you think about what you do. It's immature. And he says, in the light of eternity and in the light of the eternal nature of love, we can do better than this. One of the features of childhood that I suspect Paul has in mind, and Dick Lucas, the great British preacher, points this out too, that, you know, with children find it really hard to value things, at least to value them in quite the way that grown-ups value them. So if you've had this experience, you've got your own kids or you've given to your nieces and nephews and so on at Christmas time, this happens to us all the time, to the point where we need to send a memo to the family that people buy expensive gifts for our kids and they spend 5 minutes playing with the gift and then they spend 3 weeks playing with the box or with the little bubble wrap that it comes in and just think that the box or the bubble wrap is awesome. And we need to tell mum and dad that they could please our kids with about $2 worth of stuff at Christmas. Because kids just don't value things in the same way. And in the church in Corinth, minus love, it's like someone's gone through with a sticker machine in a supermarket and put all the wrong values on the wrong things. And they're valuing things that are of a low value and they're undervaluing things that are of a high value and they're valuing people wrongly. Undervaluing the precious, overvaluing the arrogant. And Paul says that is childish and it's time to grow up. And the second picture is of a mirror. I guess in the ancient world, mirrors were probably not as good as they are today. So maybe part of it is that you just don't see yourself that well in ancient mirrors. Maybe they're a bit grainier than they are today. But I think even with a modern mirror, you know that one of the features of mirrors is they distort to the extent that you're kind of the wrong way around in a mirror. Has anyone got into home haircuts and it takes ages to work out that when you move the scissors that way, they're actually going that way. And some pretty gruesome things have happened as a result of home haircuts. And Paul says that now in our present situation, we see through a glass darkly. We see as if by reflection. But then we will see fully. And he says that, I think, because if you see into the future, which is what love allows you to do, because love is the river to eternity, we see that then we will be known even as we are fully known. And he ends with these famous words in verse 13. These three remain, faith and hope and love, but the greatest of these is love. Why? Well, love exists into eternity, but why does love exist into eternity? C.K. Barrett, another commentator, reasons it out this way. Faith, hope, and love, the great centres of the Christian faith and life. But C.K. Barrett asks this question, does God have faith? Jesus had faith, sure, but does God the Father, does the Trinitarian God have faith? And the answer is no, that God doesn't trust another God for his salvation. God isn't got his, he's not betting on someone else to make things right. So God doesn't have faith. And does God have hope? Is God looking forward to a future that's out of his control and entrusting himself to the future that someone else brings about? No. But does God have love? Yeah, God not only has love, God is love. Love has always been and always will be. Because love is who God is, as Father, Son, and Spirit. It has always been true and will always be true. When we prophesy, when we sing, when we preach, we participate in a contingent, this world purposed for edification thing. It's kind of useful or not. It's kind of helpful or not. It's something to do with this world and these circumstances, and we're trying to aid and abet each other in the Christian life and our freakish failures and our weird, like, creatureliness and so on. We're just trying to help one another on with the prophecies and the tongues and the preaching and so on. But when we participate in love, you participate in the life of God, because you participate in the thing that has always and will always be true. So I think the revolution of chapter 12 is to stop thinking in terms of spiritual manifestations, that's their language, and to start thinking in terms of charisma, that's Paul's language, to think of yourself not as a spiritual but as a gift to the church. And I think the thing that Paul is going for here is to think of church not as a venue for self-expression, but as a place in which to participate in God as we participate in love. That's the grenade, and then this afternoon we see the shrapnel. Let's pray. Father, help us to treasure love, not as a contingency or a thing that we do, but as a way of participating in that which is true, because it's always true of you. Help us, Father, to put aside our need for self-expression or our need for acknowledgement or our need for achievement, and to follow the most excellent way, the way of love. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.